Hi folks, I'm Mark Fallows and this is the Impossible Network podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast player. And please leave a rating and a review because it helps more people find us. If you want to find out more of what we get up to or suggest who we interview next, follow us on Instagram at The Impossible Network or visit theimpossiblenetwork.com. Okay, let's get started.
My choice to participate in that discussion and try to sort of intellectually defend myself as opposed to angrily defend myself certainly changed the trajectory of my life, in that I then started writing for Speak Up and had a whole new posse of friends that are still my friends today. I ended up meeting the editor-in-chief of Print Magazine en route to a Speak Up event for the AIGA. That changed my life. Joyce Ryder Kay. Then I started working for Print Magazine. That experience introduced me to Stephen Heller. He helped me with my first book deal. He invited me to co-found the Masters in Branding program that we're sitting in right now doing this podcast. So I would say that a whole arc of my life wouldn't have been possible without that one serendipitous situation.
One of the most influential voices in design, she's led the redesign of over 200 global brands, is co-founder of the Masters in Branding program at New York's School of Visual Arts, an author of 6 books, and host of one of the most popular and longest-running podcasts, Design Matters, is this week's guest, Debbie Millman. As a guest on countless podcasts, we avoid going over much of what you may have already heard in other interviews. Instead, we dive deep into who Debbie is. We cover the impact of Debbie's upbringing, her parents' divorce at age 8, the fear of her father, the abuse she suffered from her brutally violent stepfather. We discuss how she sought refuge in her imagination, the visualization of her future life in a drawing she did as a child, and why Manhattan became her non-negotiable. Debbie recounts with impact the terror of the 9/11 attacks, the lifelong challenge to prove her self-worth, the reliance that came from failure and rejection, and the power of her hope and ambition. We explore her perspective on curiosity and creativity, her youthful creative pursuits, the belief-inspiring effect of a professor at university, and the serendipitous and positive impact that a negative post on the Speak Up blog ultimately had in defining the arc of her life going forward. And we discuss so much more. I hope you enjoy this emotive exploration into the life design of Debbie Millman. Debbie.
Hi.
Hi, Debbie. Thank you very much for being on the Impossible Network.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it and appreciate your time. And it's wonderful. I've been really looking forward to this interview. As we say to all our guests, we like to explore their childhood and understand more about your upbringing and the impact of your life and your life, particularly in design, branding and podcasting. Maybe actually that's something I'm going to come and ask you. You interviewed Chantel Martin, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, we interviewed Chantel the other week.
She's wonderful.
And yeah, it just made me think, I was walking over here, about the question of you are you and who are you. We'll maybe come and talk about that a little bit further into the interview.
Okay.
All right. So you were born, I believe, in New York, in Brooklyn, to a pharmacist, entrepreneurial father and a seamstress mother.
Well done.
There you go. Yeah. And you moved through the boroughs as you grew up. And then your parents separated when you were 8, 9 years
eight
old?
Eight, 9 years old.
8, 9 years
yes.
old, yeah.
Yes.
There's a personal relevance to me, given that I separated and left Edinburgh to go to London and left my daughter behind aged 8. So that must have impacted a lot on your emotional development.
Yeah. I mean, I think it would anybody. I don't know that that's something that is specific to me. I think anybody's parents separating when you're still in those formative years is something that affects you.
Can you sort of look back and when you've charted your life and you consider your sense of self-belief and your identity at that age, is there anything that you can expand upon and unpack around that sort of period of your life that had a significant impact?
Well, it was the late 60s, early 70s when this was happening. And so divorce was not a common thing. I remember asking my mother after hearing my parents fight and being very scared at what that meant. I remember asking her one night as she was tucking me into bed, are you and daddy getting divorced? And she said, oh, no, no, it takes a really long time for something like that to happen. And then, in fact, they did get divorced shortly thereafter. But at the time, there was a lot of stigma to it. And I remember some of my so-called friends teasing me because my parents were getting divorced, and in fact one even suggesting it was because I was a bad daughter, but that had nothing to do with it. But I remember at the time, actually being relieved because my father really scared me, and the fact that he would no longer be around full time to scare me actually was something that made me feel somewhat calmer. But it was super complicated, and there were a lot of emotions and lots of layers, because I remember also there was an issue with his payment of child support, and we all had to go to court, my mother had to go to court, and she made the very wise decision of bringing her children with her to court. After my parents got divorced, I didn't see my father for 5 years. And so the idea that I was then going to see him, despite the fact that I had initially been relieved, I was really...
You went from age 8 to around age 13 without actually seeing him or having any sort of custodial...
Yes.
Meetings.
It was, as I said, it was super complicated. My mother got remarried very quickly after they got divorced, not because she was seeing anybody at the time, but because she couldn't be alone. My dad, in fact, was seeing someone at the end of their marriage, which is why they split up. Mm-hmm. He didn't get married again for many, many years and ended up marrying somebody completely different. My stepfather was a brutal, violent person who was adamant that my father was a bad person and that we shouldn't see him, my brother and I. And so in the few times between their getting divorced and her getting remarried that I did see my dad, he would beat my brother and I after we would come back. And so that ended up making it impossible for me to see him, because I couldn't get beaten anymore. I didn't want to get beaten anymore. My brother, actually, he endured it a little bit longer than I did, but I said, okay, I'm not going to see him because I couldn't deal with the brutalization.
But your mother was aware of this.
Yeah. Yeah, she was.
So what was driving him to be so violent?
Probably his upbringing. I mean, that was just the tip of the iceberg with what he did to us. He tortured us. I mean, I have said publicly that my upbringing was like an episode of Criminal Minds or Law & Order SVU. I mean, it was brutal. And, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were interviewing Jose Freire, the gallerist,
yes,
a few weeks ago, and he was telling us a story about the brutality of the upbringing he had with the Catholic Church and his father,
yeah,
and how he took solace in coming to New York, age 13, to go to cinemas in 1973 because that was a safe place.
Right. Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
It's just incredible. Yeah.
I didn't have any safe place, really. Mm-hmm. My safe place was my imagination.
Yeah, I was about to talk to you about your creativity and curiosity and your imagination, because obviously, having listened to a number of interviews with you, there's that famous story where you drew at age 8,
yeah,
a depiction of your future self.
Isn't that amazing?
It is incredible, particularly at that age, to have done it with such sort of accuracy. But I'm just wondering, when clearly you were a creative and curious child, and doing that, what stimulated you to actually sort of draw that drawing at that particular time? When you flash forward to when you did your Milton Glaser exercise in life design in the class, it's almost like a mini version of that.
It is, actually.
8 years old.
It is. I have no memory of doing the drawing. I know that I did it. I signed it. It's definitely my childhood style of drawing. I found it quite by accident. It wasn't something that I'd kept and was holding preciously as a memento of my childhood. I found it as an adult. So seeing it, and for those that are listening that might not be aware of what it looks like, it's a drawing that I did about 8 or so years old. I think it was actually before my parents got divorced. I was born in Brooklyn, lived in Queens and Staten Island, as you mentioned. Yes. I was moving through the boroughs, but hadn't lived in Manhattan. My only experience of Manhattan was what I saw when I went to the dentist and what I saw on television. And so
two really good reasons not coming back to Manhattan, actually.
I drew a city scene, a typical city scene with a street scene of buildings and transportation, trucks and cars and cabs and people walking. And I think I was walking with a little girl walking with her mother. And I'm assuming that was me. And there's a bus that's labeled bus and a taxi that's labeled taxi and a bank that's labeled bank and a dry cleaners labeled dry cleaners and a delivery truck that's got a logo, the Lay's potato chips logo. It says Lay's potato chips, but I drew the logo at 8 years old. And I remember, I clearly remember just loving Lay's barbecue potato chips. So it makes sense that then I would do that. But that's become my life.
And you subsequently went on to
living in Manhattan, taking buses and taxis and going to banks and dry cleaners and drawing logos for a living. Yeah, it's kind of incredible.
I mean, it's going to come to this later, but I might as well ask you now, because I've heard you say that Manhattan was your reason for being here. It wasn't to be an artist. It wasn't to be a designer. The primary motivation, the driver for you was Manhattan. Why? What were your expectations about the city that made it such a compelling draw to be able to sacrifice going down maybe other routes like doing fine art or heading over to a less expensive city, but you were drawn to it? And I'm intrigued as to understand, what's the power of the city? What did it have on you?
That's a great question. I don't really have an answer. Mm-hmm. My dad, when I did start seeing him again when I was in my early teens, he did live in Manhattan. His girlfriend lived on Manhattan as well. I admired her a great deal. She was a very important person in my life. She was an independent young woman living in a brownstone in Chelsea. She was very kind to me, one of the few people in my childhood that were really kind. I think she loved me. And I don't know if it was the sense of energy, excitement, culture. I mean, Manhattan was very different in the 70s than it is now, but it was magnificent. The graffiti, the art. I can't really tell you. All I know is that it felt like home. And that was always my number one goal. And that was what I envisioned for my future. And when I graduated college, I went to school in Albany. I immediately moved down to the city and I lived with my mother for 2 weeks till I found a place to live and have been in Manhattan ever since, 36 years.
How did you feel as a New Yorker when something as traumatic as 9/11 happened?
Wow. Well, I was traveling and came home the last flight into LaGuardia Airport on September 10th, 2001. And I was walking to my office, which was in the Empire State Building at that point. And I am not a morning person. And that morning I happened to get up early. I don't know if it was because of jet lag or whatever, but I lived in Chelsea and was walking to the Empire State Building on 33rd and 34th on 5th. And I overheard somebody say that a plane went into the World Trade Center. Now, my dad had a small plane when I was growing up. He had a single engine, two-seater Cessna. And that's what I imagined. I didn't imagine a jumbo jet. Yeah. I thought, oh my God, somebody's had, and my first thought was to call my father because he had a small plane. And I called and I'm like, did you just hear that a plane flew into the World Trade Center? And he's like, yeah, I'm turning on the TV, I'm gonna watch it. And I continued walking to work and I saw people pouring out of the Empire State Building and very narcissistically thought, oh my God, I can't believe a day that I'm actually early, there's a fire drill, because I was never early. And then I heard that we were being evacuated. So very quickly, the people from my office all congregated. There's a Starbucks that was across the street. And we all congregated in front of the Starbucks. And no one knew what to do at that point. And we knew we just assumed at some point we'd be let back into the building. So we all decided, because I lived so close to the Empire State Building, that the entire office would go back to my house, my apartment. I then lived on 29th Street. And so everyone came back to my apartment because we had assumed that within an hour or two, we'd just be allowed back into the Empire State Building. And then the second plane hit. The second plane hit as we were walking to my house. Everybody started to freak out. And then the last conversation I had with my dad before the phones went down was just be safe. Try to get someplace where you could be safe, because he lived upstate New York. So he wasn't at that point concerned about himself. And so we all went back to my apartment and we put on the television and we all, you know, people were crying. People were trying to reach their families. A friend of mine, a very, very dear friend of mine, lived across the street from the World Trade Center. And she had called me because she and her now husband, they saw people jumping. they had a dog. I'm like, just take Bailey and just come to my house. And they did. And they ended up staying for quite some time and living with me until they were able to go back to their apartment. But we were just, it was just a surreal and traumatic and horrifying experience. I can't explain what it was like beyond the terror that we all felt. The smell, you know, we could smell the burning buildings for weeks afterward. People were sleeping all over my house. Some people tried walking home. It was just one of the worst days of mine and everybody's life.
I'm going to jump back to something I've heard you say, which is your perfect Venn diagram of your mother and father.
Less crazy, I hope.
Yeah, well, one of them must have exerted more influence on your identity and character.
No.
In a positive way?
My relationship with both my parents was super complicated. My dad died 4 years ago. He was incredibly charismatic, very well-spoken, very smart. I'd like to think I got some of that from him. but he was also really angry and sometimes violent and sometimes cruel. I don't know why exactly, but he broke away from a very, very religious background at an early age. And I think he had a lot of shame and felt a lot of disappointment from his family because his whole side of the family are still uber, uber Orthodox Jews. I just saw a documentary about what it's like to...
Did you, One of Us?
Yes,
yeah,
I did see it. It's incredible. Yeah. And it really gave me a perspective on what it must have been like for my father, because that's where he lived in Borough Park.
Okay, right.
So, and in Muncie, where his sister lives. So that movie was our part of my life in many, many ways. Mm. He broke away when he was 17 or 18 years old. It gave me an entirely new perspective on the shame that he must have felt while also feeling the need to do this. My mom was not an Orthodox Jew, but she was a Reform Jew. And then I was raised Reform or more conservative. But my mother, artistic, but I don't know that she's ever spent an adult day on her own without someone there to take care of her. Born again, Jew for Jesus. Mm.
But do you think, I mean, you're clearly a very resilient and driven and been driven by ambition and self-belief throughout your career. And I've heard
No. I'm going to interrupt you there. I've been driven by ambition, but not self-belief. Uh-huh. If I had self-belief, I probably wouldn't have been as driven because I would have had a better sense of self. Mm-hmm. For most of my life, all of my sense of self was outward, mm-hmm. coming in, not inward going out. So everything I did was about proving value or worth of being alive. Everything I did was to convince myself that I had meaning or purpose or a benefit or some sort of sense of being worthy.
Because when you talk about your 20s being this decade of
failure and rejection.
So that resilience, that what you were just describing there, how you dealt with it, how you carried on and kept pushing through. Presumably, even if there wasn't that sense of inner self-belief, there was a desire to be creative.
Always, mm-hmm. always. And I've talked about this. Yeah, I think my desire to make something of myself was bigger than my shame at being myself. Uh-huh. So I think that has always propelled me, that I always had more hope than shame.
And when you were a child, and going back to that drawing, were you thinking at that time, I want to be an artist, I want to be...
If I really had to pick one thing that I wanted was, I think looking back, I probably wanted to be in musical theater, but never felt like I had the talent to do that. So that wasn't even really a remote possibility. And then when I went to college, I thought maybe I'd work in publishing, and then did for some time. I worked in magazines, and then...
But was your creativity and curiosity acknowledged at school by any of the teachers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I got a lot of validation at school, mm-hmm. because I did well in school and it was easy for me. School was easy. So, yes, I got a lot of validation from my high school teachers. I got a tremendous amount of validation from my college teachers, my college professors, and so much so that I'm setting up a scholarship with SUNY Albany, my alma mater, in the name of one of my professors, Professor Helen Reguero Elam, because her encouragement and belief in me changed my life. She was really the first person who I felt believed in my intelligence, that she thought that I had a curious and interesting mind. Now, she might have done that with everybody. I think that was probably her talent. Mm-hmm. But she brought out an excitement for learning and a belief in my ability to learn that no one had done prior.
What about your experience outside school in terms of the role of play and how that affected your creativity and willingness to embrace ambiguous situations? Or
I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, I'm not a big player. Like I was never a club girl. I mean,
I was kicked out when it was weekends and after school. My mum would say, right, off you go into the woods. Mm. And I'd just be left to my own devices.
I played with Barbies, and I made my own little sort of universe with Barbies and Don dolls. And I made a magazine with one of my high school friends before we actually went into high school, the debutante, with Debbie Karp. I made my own perfumes when I was a kid. I put on shows. I would be the director, and I would have my brother and my two stepsisters play parts, and we'd put on shows for the holidays, and I'd make all of the family sit down and watch. And I love doing that. I thought that was some of my happiest memories, is doing that kind of stuff.
So in a way, going back to the idea of that perfect Venn, the sort of the entrepreneurial side and the sort of the creative side coming together.
Yeah, it took me a long time, though, I did inherit a lot of troubles as well. You know, it took me a long time to understand what it would mean to be on my own. Very similar to my mother, I was a serial monogamist, and I don't know that I'd spent one day on my own without a significant other from the time I was in college until 2017. And then I spent a year and a half without dating anyone intentionally. And that was one of the most transformative experiences of my life. And it was an amazing one, and I thought it would be terrifying, and it wasn't. It was liberating. So that was a very, very big, a really transformative experience in letting go of what I sort of by osmosis learned in a lot of ways. And then I think also coming out at a later age was a very big transformative experience. So it's hard to say which of my parents have had more impact on who I am. I would say that they both have equal amounts. And then I think also I've had a phenomenal, transformative, life-changing and life-saving therapeutic experience as well. And that's probably influenced more about who I am and how I live than either of my parents.
Okay. Going back to this positive mentorship and guidance from your teacher at school. Sorry, her name was?
Professor Helen Ruggiero Elam, E-L-A-M.
I'm intrigued. Why did you pick English literature and Russian literature and not something that was art-based to go and study at university?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Because at that point, I think I assumed that I'd go into the publishing business of some sort of be journalist. Yeah. I wasn't really I mean, I did take enough art classes to have an art minor, so I can't say that I didn't do that, but I had to declare one minor, and so I just declared Russian literature, because that was something I think at the time I had a few more credits with.
Well, we like to talk about serendipity, and obviously through your life arc, you've encountered some incredible experiences and gone in many different directions. Can you maybe just talk a bit about where you could identify where serendipity may have affected the path you went on or redirected you?
Well, certainly the biggest is my experience with Speak Up, the blog, where I discovered that I had been written about and written about meanly. And my choice to participate in that discussion and try to sort of intellectually defend myself as opposed to angrily defend myself certainly changed the trajectory of my life, in that I then started writing for Speak Up and had a whole new posse of friends that are still my friends today. I ended up meeting the editor-in-chief of Print Magazine en route to a Speak Up event for the AIGA. That changed my life. Joyce Redder Kay. Then I started working for Print Magazine. That experience introduced me to Stephen Heller. He helped me with my first book deal. He invited me to co-found the Masters in Branding program that we're sitting in right now doing this podcast. So I would say that a whole arc of my life wouldn't have been possible without that one serendipitous situation wherein Felix Sockwell decided to take my whole life down on the world's first ever design blog and forever change my life.
Well, I suppose you look back and thank him.
I do. Yeah. As often as I can. We're friends now too.
What was your feeling? And I've heard you talk a bit about this, that when you first saw it, and that immediate feeling. I think we've all encountered that element of being not shamed, but
oh, it was shamed.
Yeah,
it was shamed.
But that sort of experience, it clearly took. It feels like it took a bit of courage and bravery to actually embrace it and go forward and confront it rather than to turn your back on it. What was it inside you that gave you that drive and determination to say, I need to confront this?
Well, I thought they were wrong. And I've learned that I'm a person that likes to be right. And so when I first entered the conversation, I did so in a very disingenuous way. I entered the conversation with like, hey, how's that? How's everybody doing? Loving the conversation, which I wasn't. I was terrified and tortured by the conversation.
But this was still early days in terms of
I didn't know.
The protocols weren't there.
Exactly. Like. No, I was devastated. I was inconsolable. Here I am running a design consultancy, working, clawing my way up to the top, trying really, really hard to make a life of my own for myself and figure out how to live, and proud of what I'd accomplished at that point, because that was when I had first gotten some success in branding. And then this little upstart design blog run by a couple of dudes in their 20s decides to trash my entire practice. It nearly killed me. It was something that I didn't think I'd be able to recover from. I had no idea that one of the worst professional experience of my life was going to turn out to be the most important, that would change the trajectory of my life. At the time, I thought I was doomed. I thought that I'd have to quit my job, that I had shamed my agency, that once people started reading this, they would never want to work with Sterling or at Sterling again, and that I should, for the benefit of the business, quit. But I had no other marketable skill. So, and I had a mortgage and, you know, I just.
But you had a lot of good friends and supporters.
No, I didn't. Nobody came in to support me in that situation.
I don't even know that they knew.
Not really. No. I was so embarrassed and ashamed. I didn't want anybody to know. It wasn't like I was outraged and calling everybody and saying, you know, come in and defend me. I didn't do that. I didn't do that at all. I was so mortified by this. I think I must have tried to hide it because there was no one that I asked to defend me. Dave Weinberg, who then worked at Landor, came in and defended me, but I didn't know him. He came in and defended me at the very, very end. Thank you, Dave. Mm-hmm. But no, I wouldn't have even asked. I don't think I could have asked my friends to come in and defend me. I don't know that they could have. I don't know that there was anything to defend. This was their opinion. They thought that the Burger King logo was disgusting. They thought that the Star Wars work was bad, and they wanted me to know it. I tried to persuade them otherwise. Ultimately, I think I did. But I don't know that anybody else would have or should have or could have. And I'm glad they didn't, actually.
And what's your relationship with them?
Oh, my God. Are you kidding? I'm Armin and Bryony's eldest daughter's godmother. They're my closest friends. They're family now. I mean, Felix isn't family, but he's certainly a friend. Mm-hmm. But Armin Vitt is the founder of Speak Up. Armin and Bryony are dear, dear friends. And I am very close to their children and the godmother of their oldest daughter.
How do you counsel your students in the world that we're living in, where clearly shaming and the negative power and impact of social media can have on kids today? Do you draw on that experience to give them guidance?
No, not really. No. Not really. I think most people that know me know that part of my history. I do talk a little bit about resilience with my students, and that's an example that I'll use. But I don't really talk about rules of social media, mostly because I don't feel like I know them. I don't feel experienced enough to counsel on that.
But I suppose from a character perspective, and in terms of doing what you feel is right, following your gut.
I think they learn by osmosis how I live my life and how I teach them about branding and about consumer behavior. I think they learn about that through me and then probably can take some of those lessons into other areas of their life.
Can you talk about the role curiosity's played in some of the actions that you've taken in your life? And obviously, you've mentioned the serendipity and where that occurred. But as a curious, sort of playful child, and someone that has a desire to be in arts and some form of whether it be publishing or design and branding, is it a fuel that you're aware of, and is something that you've continued to feed, or do you just how do you nurture it?
I think that my curiosity is sort of like air. It's just something that I utilize to live. I don't think about it. I'm not conscious of it. It's very involuntary, but it is probably one of the driving factors of my existence. I am innately curious. And I think that's also why I like doing my podcast so much, because I'm innately curious about how people live their lives. And that gives me a way in to talk about that with other people. How do you live? And that curiosity fuels my questions, and that curiosity fuels everything.
I've heard you mention about, I had a boss in London that in grey used to talk about radiators and drains, and I've heard
you really?
On the podcast talking about
this. Oh, that's
this.
So funny, because that's,
I know the two types
of people. The generators and drains. I learned that from my partner at Sterling, who's also British, so maybe they all got it from the same place.
Yeah, it's a British thing.
Yeah.
A bit like term uni. But one of the things that I find a challenge is interviewing for attitude. How do you, when you're interviewing either a student or someone to hire, identify in them? What do you look for to ensure that they've got that right attitude?
Energy. Mm-hmm. It's all about energy. Energy, curiosity, passion. They don't have to be an extrovert, but they do have to exhibit a certain curiosity about the world and a certain openness about what is possible. Mm. I'm not there to pull it out of them. I would like for them to offer that as part of who they are.
And are there any particular techniques or questions that you tend to ask to uncover that, or do you just look to their work and their and what they've achieved in there?
It's really funny. I feel like I'm a terrible interviewer for jobs and for students. I think I'm a good interviewer on my podcast, but I rely on my staff here at SVA to help, because I tend to be less discerning. I want to find something that I like in everyone, and we can't accept everyone, and I can't hire everyone, but I tend to want to. So I rely on others to help me with assessment, a proper assessment. Sometimes I'll just want to hire somebody because I like them so much, and that doesn't always go well.
Churchill was often quoted as saying, I'm not sure it was Churchill that actually did say it, success isn't final and failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue that counts.
Mm.
We've touched on a little bit of courage in that particular situation where you confronted the blogger. How do you continue to nurture your own courage when you've encountered many situations that individuals of lesser character would have not responded and moved on from, but you have? And you've achieved some stellar moments in your career and seem to be on a continuing path. As you say in your interview with David Lee Roth,
yeah.
It is a never-ending path.
Yeah, one would hope.
And there's probably sort of an incredible amount more to come. But courage, it's because I know that there's this whole thing around courage and competence and confidence, but for me, courage is something separate. It's something that burns inside you. It's a drive. And I know that we've talk about self-belief and maybe the lack of when you were younger. But is this something that's grown over time inside you?
Courage? Has courage grown inside me? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, have you become, as you have overcome these challenges that were being thrown in your way or put in your way, and you've been resilient and vindicated and experienced success, I'd assume that your self-belief is strengthened and that it makes you even more courageous.
I don't think I'm more courageous. I think I just want a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I think it's only courageous to do something before you do it. And then after you do it, you look back and you think, what took so long? You know, coming out is a really big thing for me. I didn't come out until I was 50. I was really worried. I had my own inner homophobia to deal with, my own shame, my feelings that people would reject me or not like me. And now I really understand what pride means. And that's a very, very big thing to me. My house right now is covered in pride flags. Very happy to say. But, you know, I look back on that experience and I think, oh, yeah, well, you know, it was only 7 years ago. So the world is a lot kinder place right now. So then I feel shame that I didn't come out sooner because I wasn't brave enough. So, you know, this always still a lot of beating up. But
do you think it was, I mean, I know you spent all this time with Sterling and you came to that pivotal moment where you had to decide whether you became CEO or not.
Right.
Was there that intersection? Is that when you felt that it was time for you to come out?
No, I came out before that.
So it was before
I came out before that because I had to talk to my partners and tell them that I was coming out. And, you know, they didn't know that, you know, some people are like, what took you so long? They had no idea. So I came out in 2012. So it was 7 years ago. And I left Sterling 2 years ago. So, no, it didn't. And my coming out didn't impact our business at all in a negative way. It was actually fine. It was actually business as usual.
What triggered the moment, the decision to say, finally, I've got the resolve and the conviction to say, now's the time.
To come out or to leave Sterling?
To come out.
Oh, I fell in love with a woman. And she wasn't going to live in the closet with me.
Yeah. So all these years, there wasn't a sense of your identity, sexual identity, and what your preferences were up to that point?
Well, I think that I had dabbled, as I used to like to say. I suspected that there might be this part of me back in my 20s. But again, I felt so much shame about being who I was and so damaged to begin with that any other sense of being other just was unbearable. So it wasn't even a consideration set. But I was reading Anne Bannon novels in my 20s under the covers with a flashlight. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear. But then, as I said, I fell in love with a woman and then it was, you know, all systems ago.
Well, congratulations. I think it was great. Fantastic. So just building on that, we've talked about courage. When you talk about your decade of failure and rejection, what do you think? Which failures do you think have been the most defining in your journey in driving you forward?
I haven't really ranked the failures. I really don't know. Nothing. Yeah, I couldn't rank them. Yeah. They all are just there. And the thing about them now is that I don't see them as failures anymore. I just see them as stepping stones. But you can only say that in hindsight. I wouldn't say any of those things were failures because I wouldn't be here right now if they hadn't failed.
It is a strange thing. I remember I was working for an agency in London called WCRS, and I went to that job working on a Land Rover account. This is going to be the best job I've ever had. And I last no more than 2 years. And they let me go with a nice little payoff, as you do. But I felt at that point, well, that's my ad career over. That's just there's no going forward now.
Of course.
And how am I going to deal with telling people? But it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Exactly.
Because it took me down the digital direction that then opened up all these other opportunities.
Exactly. Now, Dan Gilbert would call that synthesized happiness. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with synthesized happiness and I'm fine with organic happiness, as long as you're happy. I can't say that any of the things that happened wouldn't have landed me right now, right here. Same thing even with my childhood. Some of the most important work I'm doing now is working with Mariska Hargitay and the Joyful Heart Foundation to eradicate sexual violence. Who knows if I'd have been doing that if I hadn't experienced it? Do I feel like that is the most important thing I do? Probably. Mm-hmm. So it's all perspective, but it might take 50 years for that to happen.
But yeah. And it's allowing you to sort of start to challenge and break that cycle.
Right.
Going back to your stepfather and father.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, do I wish that it were different? Yes. Do I wish that I didn't have to struggle so hard in order to understand love? Absolutely. Would I have liked to have had less violence in my life? Yeah. But at this point, it's made me who I am. I do think that had I been better parented, I might have been a happier person, but I'm very happy now, and that's what matters most to me.
I read a book last year by Robert Lustig called Hacking the American Mind.
I haven't read it, but I've heard about it.
It's really good because he breaks down the sort of the neurological way that the brain works in relation to dopamine and serotonin and oxytocin, and how the importance of, obviously, connection and creativity plays on the release of serotonin and therefore happiness. And it's funny, I was interviewing a guy called Fabrice Grinda, who's number one angel investor in the world.
Oh, wow.
And he's got a technique that he talks about hedonic...
The hedonic treadmill?
Treadmill. And he said, I'm just an inherently happy person, but when I'm creating, I'm even happier.
Yeah, I'm happiest when I'm making things. That's how I define my sense of happiness.
Yeah, so I think there's something really interesting in terms of you've had this struggle. You've talked openly about your struggle with depression. Has it occurred at times when you've been in a less creatively prolific, or is it just been other factors that have contributed?
The depressions that I felt, I had a depression in 2003 and a depression in 2015. The depression in 2015 was sparked by a confluence of some really difficult situations. My father unexpectedly died. I was dumped, and I was changing my job situation at Sterling, and I moved for the first time in over two decades. So those four yeah. things contributed to my kind of falling apart for a couple of months. And then the situation in 2003 was also relationship and a lot of external circumstances that beat me down and gave me a sense of despair. But I've recovered from both.
So the reason I also bring up Fabrice, who's a fascinating character, and if you get a chance to go on his site and read some of his essays, he writes letters to himself. So going back to your exercise with Milton and then what you do with your students, there's something I find fascinating in that, because I used to write down my goals and affirmations and follow them all. One of them I had when I, back in the day, living in Scotland, was to live in San Francisco, and I posted a picture in my little diary of Union and Hyde and a building, and I ended up living there 10 years later.
I love that.
Which is incredible.
It's like Eluna's dream about her white room and then finding it and painting in it. It's incredible.
So talk to me more about, clearly Fabrice is, and the way he does it, he writes letters to himself, 20,000, 30,000 words.
Wow.
He's off the
scale. That's a book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he does this every 2-3 years.
That's incredible. No wonder he's the biggest angel investor in the world.
But then he has his mentors and his advisors, who he then takes counsel from. And then he almost goes down a test-driven development approach, where he throws things on the wall and goes down different routes and then finds and refines. And
yeah, I don't do that.
So given you did this with Milton, and I've heard you say that pretty much 98% of it is there already.
Yeah. I did another one.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. What's your future focus
Well,
on
I'm not
now?
I'm not going to reveal everything.
On.
No, not a chance. I'm not going to reveal what I wrote, but I will tell you that it was big and bold, and a few of them are happening. And it's incredible. It's incredible because they're big, fat dreams that you don't ever imagine happening. And then all of a sudden, boom.
President Milman.
Yeah, if I was going to do anything, I would run for mayor of New York, but I'm not going to. But I fantasized about it. Yeah. It could be, but I fantasized about it, but I'm not going to do
it. The running could be really good fun. You could sort of imagine all the sort of the comments in the comment section.
Right? The branding, too.
I know, yeah. Oh, we could do with a bit of that.
A good logo, good candidate logo. Yeah.
And then you might need some help with the social media from your students.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. What principles do you stand by?
Loyalty. Generosity. Kindness.
I second all of those. What hard choices have you had to make that were tough at the time but did turn out to be the right decision?
Leaving Sterling. Coming out. Leaving a relationship.
Okay.
Starting a new one.
Where do you go to discover new ideas?
The internet.
Really?
Yeah.
Ah.
And museums.
Ah, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A nice combination. What about when you need space to think?
I look out my bedroom windows. I spend a lot of time daydreaming.
Any particular time of day?
Morning.
Always.
Every morning.
Is that your meditation practice?
It's not a meditation practice. It's just a habit. Mm. I'm not meditating. I'm just staring.
And ideas come to you?
Yes. And I walk a lot. and ideas come to me when I'm walking.
What are your favorite walking paths?
Just anywhere downtown. I love walking. I walked back and forth to work. I walk back and forth to most meetings. I love walking.
What's your perspective on failure?
I hate it. I loathe it. I cry.
But you've beaten it.
For the just in the past, there's still more to come.
I know. That's just the reality of life. It's just one.
I don't know that I've beaten it. I think I've overcome the
okay,
feelings.
That's fair point. Yeah. Who have you met that's most surprised you?
Roxane Gay.
That was a quick answer.
Well, she's my partner now.
Right.
And she surprised me in every way.
We might have the same answer to the next question. Who's made you reevaluate yourself?
My therapist.
Yeah. How do you keep up with technology?
I don't. Other people help me.
Well, you're surrounded by your students.
Exactly. Yeah. Other people help me.
The impossible question. What would your advice be to someone maybe 20, 30 years your junior that is being told their dream, their grand ambition is not possible?
If you want it more than anything, make it your non-negotiable and dedicate everything that you have to making it happen.
That's lovely. Your non-negotiable, remember, being New York City.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a non-negotiable now? Is it still New York?
No, I wouldn't say it's New York. An open heart.
We've never had that answer. Final two questions. We'd like to offer listeners a book that when they come up with the best comments in the comment section, which book should we recommend other than the many of the books that you've written?
Hunger by Roxane Gay.
Okay. Who should we interview next?
Emily Oberman from Pentagram.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a really, really good interview. I really want to say well done. You're a very, very good interviewer. Well,
thank you very much. Can I just acknowledge you for your candor and your openness to vulnerability? I think it's a lesson we can all follow in the footsteps from what you've done by being so open. So many of us are closed and we live in denial of the lives we've led before. And I think the path you've taken and the way that you've told your story with such a compelling and emotive manner is inspiration for people. And I hope you continue to do it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Debbie. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review because it helps more people find us. Just go to iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player to listen and subscribe. If you want to learn more or have someone you'd like us to interview, visit theimpossiblenetwork.com or follow us on Instagram at theimpossiblenetwork. This show is a Fabrica Collective production and is produced by Bettina McKelly and Elaine Castillo Keller. For now, be curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.